When we embrace who we want to be and stop pretending, then we can flow and it becomes easy. That's what life needs to be. That's why we're in so much pain right now, collectively in society. Too many people pretending and not enough people getting to be who they want to be. I meant to say this earlier, but when I was in the Army, when I went to Afghanistan, some of my best memories are when I was actually working with Australian soldiers. They were some of the best and just funniest dudes to be around. And every single year for the last like 8 years, that everybody that I knew from then, they always wish me happy birthday a day before my actual birthday because they get it ahead of time. But it always cracks me up because they're always the first ones to wish me happy birthday. Never fails.
So how long ago were you in the Army? Tell me about that. Like, how'd you get into the Army? I definitely want, because I read your story and it's super interesting, and the whole transition into more of a, like a spiritual life. Love your story, and I definitely want to dig into it.
Yeah, so I pretty much grew up with wanting to be in the military. A lot of my family members were in the military. And, I was not super young when 9/11 happened, but I was old enough to know what was going on. And it impacted me. It stayed with me. And then when I turned 18, as soon as I graduated high school, I was gone. I went off, did basic training, went to my first unit in Fort Lewis, Washington. And I deployed about a year after getting to my unit. I went to Afghanistan in 2011 to 2012. And, doing counterinsurgency operations and stuff like that. And then as you mentioned, I kind of went through like a transitory phase of my life when I got out of the military. I kind of just had like an identity crisis, and like I needed to figure out who I was, what my purpose was. And that's what led me to all this kind of philosophy, spiritual, religion stuff. I just love studying it. The basics of it is that mindfulness and meditation were ultimately what really helped me. And I learned about those things by learning about Buddhism, and it changed my life for the better. It helped me kind of learn how to deal with a lot of the stuff going on in my life.
That's amazing. Coming back from the Army, were there some habits or layers that you had to unlearn? Yeah,
definitely. It's ironic. I'm sure people listening have seen movies where they see that kind of thing happening. A good one is the movie called The Hurt Locker. And the guy, the main character, he comes back from deployment and he's standing in a grocery like store, and he's looking at all these different options of cereal, and he can't figure out which one to pick because he's just looking at it like, there's so many options. I don't know what to do here. And I can relate to that because I went from Afghanistan back to the United States in a matter of like a week or two. And it just was not enough time to turn that off. And there's no decompressioning that happens. There's no, like, you don't come back and then take a break and then kind of like learn how to be a person again. That stuff stays on, and you come back and you're just like, you don't know how to turn it off. That was probably the biggest struggle, was not learning how to turn it off.
How long were you deployed for?
I was deployed for a year.
Wow. And then was it, so you did the training, you got deployed, you were deployed for a year and you came back, and then you sort of didn't go back to the Army, and then you started transitioning? Is that sort of what happened?
So when I came back from Afghanistan, that was 2012, almost immediately I re-enlisted for another 4 years, and then I stayed in the Army for four more years. I wanted to go back to deploy. That's why I went to a new unit. I went to Fort Campbell, Tennessee, Kentucky, and we were scheduled to deploy, and then a few months down the line, that mission got scrubbed, so I never went back, which was probably a good thing, in retrospect. So I came back, and then I spent 4 years in what's called like the Garrison Army, which means that like you're not going on deployment, you're just doing lots of training and doing kind of the same stuff over and over again, trying not to get in trouble. And then in 2017, I got out. I did all the processes, did the paperwork, and then just like that, I was gone. I was out.
Wow. How are those 8 years compared to those 1 year you had deployed in Afghanistan? Is it completely different, or is it similar sort of environment and you have to be just as switched on?
No, the way that I try to describe it to people is it's kind of like football, right? Like football players train year round to go to the Super Bowl. And for the military, like being on deployment is the Super Bowl, right? So, my 1 year in Afghanistan, and plus I had such a very cool opportunity that most people don't get. My particular unit was attached to Special Forces operations. And so we did things that most people don't get to do. We weren't staying on like a big base. We were pretty much out in the middle of nowhere. We didn't really wear uniforms like everybody else had to. We could grow facial hair. We had supplies and equipment that other units wouldn't necessarily have. So it was very cool. I mean, it was dangerous, but it was very cool. So it was very unique, but definitely it was like being in the Super Bowl. And then when you come back, it's just like the same training over and over again. And it's kind of boring and repetitive.
Got it. And what was your specialty? Like, what did you do?
Yeah, so my particular MOS, for those who are like military backgrounds, mine was 11 Bravo, which meant I was an infantryman. And at the time, I was a team leader. And then at times, I was also a squad leader. It just kind of depended. And our team dynamic worked a little bit differently because we weren't really like, we were just a team of like 13 to 14 people. We didn't have like a full platoon like a normal infantry unit would. So sometimes the leadership roles played a little differently. So, but here's the interesting part. Because we were working with special forces, everybody kind of had to learn a task. We all had to learn things around the camp that became our specialties. Like some people were good at the electronics and were able to mess with our equipment and make it work better or whatever. Some people were better at knowing the mechanical side of things, like how to fix our vehicles when we needed some repairs. And then for me specifically, I ended up being like the quasi armorer. So like I kept track of all the ammunition we had for all this. I mean, countless different types of weapons and explosives and rocket launchers and snipers and sniper ammo and shotguns. I kept track of all that ammo so that I could request more ammunition whenever we needed stuff. But then also my other background was in demolition. So every time we went out on missions, I had to make these small explosives so that if we ran into IEDs or mines when we were out on mission, we had enough explosives in the truck to blow them up. And we needed a lot because we often ran into explosives on the road. It wouldn't even be surprising if we ran out of explosives before we could even keep going.
How do you spot an explosive? Does it pop up from the ground? Do you have like meters that detect it beforehand? Are these literal explosives on the ground where if you drive past it, it would blow up the tank? And then tell me about that.
So typically, and at least this is again just as for Afghanistan, and honestly every area is different, it depends on what like insurgent group is in the area. But for my area, what we ran into mostly was what's called an IED, which is an improvised explosive device, which usually is made, it's kind of like Home Depot style, right? Like they take fertilizer, they take explosives, whatever they can get their hands on, and they put it in these yellow jugs. And anybody that's deployed will know what I'm talking about, but they put them in these yellow jugs, and then they have what's called a pressure plate. Okay, so you can remote activate these things. One way is through a cell phone, and it has a pager or some kind of thing, and you send a text message or a phone call to it and it blows it up. Those don't work as good because our trucks have jammers on them that jam the signal, so it doesn't really work. But the most common is what's called a pressure plate. And that can be done kind of several different ways, but typically it's you take two pieces of wood, and then the one that I've seen personally was like they took a saw blade and that was the piece in the middle. And then you have electrical wire that connects the charge. So basically what happens is when a heavy truck rolls over the two pieces of wood, it smushes together the electrical wire and the saw blade, which makes the electrical connection that you need to charge the blasting cap typically, and blows up the whole thing.
And you'd be able to spot these far ahead?
No, I'm sorry. I meant to say that. So no, these are typically buried in the ground and they're not visible. The only way that we could ever really know was that we had because again, we were in a small team, we paid Afghani basically mercenaries, we paid them to patrol with us, and they would walk out in front of our convoy with mine detectors and metal detectors. And they were really good at their job, which is why we trusted them and paid them the way that we did. They were very good at their job and usually found them. I mean, we found so many in our area that we even got like a ceremonious congratulations from Special Operations Command because we had found so many in our area.
That's crazy. And you know, right now I can definitely tell how you have this really calm and zen energy about you. Cameron, was it always this way? Were you like that in the army, or did you have to transition into this sort of calm and zen state that I'm feeling now?
Yeah, no, if you had met me probably 5 years ago, no. I was a very angry and hostile person. I'd be outright violent at times. And in my book, Caveman to Philosopher, there's an incident that I share that it's not my most proud moment, but I had an interaction with one of my soldiers that was less than ideal. And I didn't physically hurt him, but I emotionally harmed him. And it was so wild and so just ruthless that people around me were like, man, what is wrong with you? Like, you have problems. And that was kind of what started me thinking like maybe I need to get help. And that's when I started to go to therapy, was shortly after that incident. But I mean, it wasn't just that I was like a loose cannon, but I was doing things that would regularly get me in trouble in the army. I didn't care about rank. I didn't really care about the structure. I just did what I wanted to do, and almost a narcissistic fashion.
What do you think was the root cause of it? Was it because you're always on edge when you're deployed and things can always happen and you're always sort of near death and it forces you to have that character, or was it something else?
I think that that's part of it, but a lot of it is just the environment of the military. When I first got in, I was very much like a Boy Scout. You know, I wanted to do the right thing. I wanted to be a patriot. But quickly, I realized most of the people I was serving with were not like that. They were, people trying to get away from a bad home life, or, you know, drug addicts that were trying to get off drugs and, again, getting away from their home life. Or just people that wanted to get their college paid for. So that meant that they didn't, you know, some of them could be patriotic, and I'm not disparaging anybody from what they did. I'm just saying that it's kind of like, you know, it's like high school, right? There are clubs and there are cliques, and there was not very many people that would be in my clique. And so I didn't fit in. And the only way that I learned how to fit in was by emulating what my leaders were doing, right? And my leaders were ruthless. The people that were in charge of me were mean and almost like a pit bull, right? The characteristics of a pit bull. And I'll never forget that when I first became a team leader, my squad leader told me, he said, these dudes are not your friends. They're, you know, they are supposed to be afraid of you, and you are like a pit bull on a leash. And my job is to pull back on the leash when you're getting too out of control. So basically what he was saying to me is, I want you to be out of control, and I'll tell you when you're going too far. And so I just adopted that personality. Now, when I was in the military, I'm sorry, when I was in Afghanistan, that was kind of the mindset I had, right? I'm a fresh team leader. I'm kind of developing that. But then we're in a very relaxed environment where we're with special forces, and, you know, we're more of like a baseball team than like an infantry platoon where there's discipline at every level, right? We kind of had to work that way to survive because we had such a small amount of people. And then we come back from that, and my experiences in Afghanistan were in such a way that it made me not trust people anymore. And that included the people I worked with. And the only thing I knew how to do was just to be the biggest asshole I could possibly be. And that was what, by definition, was a good leader. And so I emulated that and I adopted it. But then eventually that became my personality. It wasn't just a work thing. That was just my personality. And then after I came back from Afghanistan, I started doing steroids, which is what fueled it too. That made it worse, because now I was like getting bigger and stronger, all the classic narcissistic traits.
Interesting. Yeah, that's something that I definitely was shocked by, because I'm sort of surrounded, when I sort of listen to podcasts, you see all these sort of ex-SEAL team leaders, Nim Dai, the guy who climbed the 14 peaks, all these people, they seem so charismatic, so nice, so like brotherly, and there's this sort of, they share stories about, you know, being in this sort of brotherhood with their sort of squad and team, and they definitely don't have this sort of on edge, angry, driven sort of energy. Yeah, is it because the SEALs are different to sort of the Army? Tell me about that.
Yeah, I would say that when you get more into these specialized units like the Rangers and Green Berets and Delta and SEALs, they really are more of, like a baseball team, right? Where you're tight knit and you have to rely on each other because you're in small numbers. Typically in like a regular infantry platoon, most guys don't stick around that long. You dudes come and go all the time. You don't even remember people's names sometimes because they're gone. They're there and gone. I mean, and even yourself, right? I was only at that unit that I deployed out of for 3 years, one of them being deployed and then coming back. Basically after that year, a bunch of dudes I knew got out or went to a new unit. And then eventually I did. And then when I got to my new unit, the same kind of thing happened. You know, people come and go all the time and it's hard to make those connections. And I wouldn't say that that's everyone's experience. This is totally mine. And it's just a weird thing for me. I came in right when I was 19. So I wasn't really allowed to drink. And so I had my own room to myself at the beginning. And I was a higher ranking, like lower enlisted person. So I just was kind of in this middle ground where like, I'm not really old enough to drink, even though like we kind of did it anyways. And I'm not high enough rank to be hanging out with the non-commissioned officers, but I'm a little bit higher rank than like the low grade privates. And the biggest thing other than that was the attitude. I wanted to be there. I wanted to be a professional soldier. And a lot of other guys just didn't. They were there just to fulfill some needs or whatever and then get out.
That's crazy. And were those type of people deployed, or did the Army so specifically sort of select certain types of people you have to pass in order to be deployed?
No, the only thing that you really have to pass is like, you know, if you're flagged, right, which could be from like medical reasons or whatever. Typically, like you're really only going to get flagged if you have some kind of mental stuff going on, you know, like for me, like when I was getting out, I was flagged because I had PTSD. I was diagnosed with it. And so technically I wasn't allowed to deploy, but I only had a few months anyway. So it was okay. It wasn't that big of a deal, but typically that's what will happen. If you're like constantly in trouble getting like you know UCMJ'd all the time, which is like the Uniform Code of Military Justice, if you're constantly getting in trouble like that, then yeah, that probably would prevent you. But other than that, not really.
Wow, so that means all the people that were just in the military just to pay off their college degree or get away from home or sort of get off drugs, they were also deployed to Afghanistan maybe?
Yes.
Wow, tell me about the catalyst for change. Like, you got PTSD, you were sent back, you blew up, you got really angry at some team members, and then you went to therapy. What was that catalyst for change? I guess it was you, people saying that you're not okay, and you seeing yourself emotionally sort of hurt someone else.
Yeah, I mean, and there were times where I would say that I pushed the boundaries of like physical like abuse on other people too, you know. I mean, I was doing steroids, I was a big guy, I was strong. And you know, a lot of it was like pent up aggression from like how I was treated, because like when I was a fresh new guy, I could treat like crap, you know, and it just I hated it. And it wasn't the band of brothers dream that I had envisioned, which is, you know, that's my fault. That's my own perception problem. But again, I was so young. I didn't understand that. I didn't get it. And then, you know, now I'm in this position of power. I'm doing steroids, so I'm getting stronger and bigger, and I have respect now like I never had before. So yeah, a lot of things influence that. But, you know, here's what I will say, kind of fast forwarding a little bit. The one thing that really helped me get over that, all of it, was I was meditating one day and I kind of tried to envision myself back then and me now, and almost trying to like have a conversation with myself and just be kind of trying to like talk to my younger self and understand, you know, of course this is all being done in your mind's eye, but I wanted to understand myself back then. And then I'll not only understand myself, but then tell myself back then that it's okay. You know, like I used to beat myself up all the time for how mean I was to people and how ruthless I became. Cause that's not who I pride myself in being. It's not really, nobody wants to be that way. but it's easy to get caught up in it. And so once I learned how to let go and to forgive myself of those things, it made it a lot easier.
Interesting. Something I do realize is that I've only realized this recently over the last few sort of months is that I was like, you know, there'll be times I'm just angry. It's probably because I'm burnt out, a lot of work, and sort of when my candle is sort of burnt out, I get easily angry and pissed up about little things. And I think I'm starting to realize that I'm not angry at a team member for not doing their job, but I'm more angry at myself. Like, I'm always beating myself up and I'm like, man, like, why is this, like, I should have been more clear when giving instructions to this team member. It's my fault. I hired that person, man. Like, why am I allowing this? So it was always blaming myself. And I noticed that all my anger would be sort of just pent up and built up. And, you know, I don't usually blow up at people, but I sort of blow up at myself. Or when I do show anger towards a team member, I'm sort of self-hurting for some reason. Is that something you experienced? Because you talked about how you're just like forgiving yourself.
I would say that I was the opposite. I had a problem with blaming others. Nowadays, I do that to myself. I beat myself up, you know? And the only thing I'd like to point out is that it's okay to take responsibility, but be careful how much blame you place on yourself, right? Like, because it's one thing to just take the blame in like a candid manner and be like, ah, yeah, that was my fault. I did that. But it's another thing to always blame yourself and to self-implode, right? Blowing up on other people's not great, but blowing up on yourself isn't good either. And there's a difference between blame and responsibility, right? For me, I didn't like say I did all these bad decisions. I did all this. The very basic thing I recognized was that, like, okay, I was in the army. I went to war. All these things happened, right? Well, if we go back to the very beginning, what triggered all of that? Me signing my name on the dotted line. I took responsibility for making the choice to go and do it. And I knew that there'd be consequences. I knew that there'd be danger. And then when all of that happened, it's like I forgot that I made that choice. And it's like, oh, well, I'm just going to blame everyone else now. That's what I had to accept. That's what made me feel better.
Interesting. Yeah, because like as you were talking, I was like, okay, the other day I watched a bunch of like, I binge watched a whole season of this TV show. And by the end of it, I was like, man, like I was just pissed. I was like, damn, like, why did I do that? Why did I download it? Why did I watch that? And I was just angry at myself. There were days where I woke up exhausted because I slept late the previous night. I was like, damn, like, Andy, why did you freaking sleep late? So those were the things that I would do to myself. And I think one, it definitely pushes me, so I avoid making the same mistake. But then I'm then put in this weird limbo where I'm not really enjoying myself, but I'm not fully condemning myself and then avoiding doing it. So I'm in this limbo where I'm not really resting and I'm not really productive.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's common. That's guilt, right? You feel guilty because you know there's a million other things you should be doing or could be doing, or as you said, you need that sleep. And that's a fine line to walk, because the correct thing for that, right? The correction there is balance. But that's like, there's no rule book for that, right? Like, there's no book that you could read that's going to tell you like, all right, well, maybe if you only watch half the season and then you go to bed, then you're going to be fine, right? But that may be one solution, but that doesn't always work for your entire life, right? Like, there are going to be times where you stay up late and you do this, right? But here's something I wrote down. And anybody that's listening can use this, right? If you're ever faced with a problem or in a situation where you have to choose whether you're going to do it or not, just ask yourself a very simple question. Is this meaningful, right? And that doesn't mean that it has to, like, for it to be meaningful, it means you're going to make $1 million or that, you know, you're going to cure cancer. It could just mean that, did you watching that season, was it meaningful in the way that it made your life better? Like, did you need to do that for your own sake? And if it is, or if it was, then that's okay. It's okay to sacrifice sleep for that. But if you're doing it regularly and you're sacrificing sleep all the time because you're doing things like that, right? Then it's probably not as meaningful as it could be or it should be.
Interesting. Something I definitely want to dig into is sort of your view on Buddhism and your view on meditation and how you sort of incorporated those things. But the thing that I'm even more curious about is once you were able to transition and sort of work on yourself, the last piece, I guess the most important piece is what's like what's your why? What's pushing you to wake up each morning nowadays? Because I think that is probably something a lot of people struggle with coming out of the army.
Yeah. Well, I would say a lot of people are struggling with that in general, not even just in the army, right? Like, especially in the last couple of years, right? I mean, I'm sure you know, right? Like, you're not, I'm sure you're paying attention to what's going on in our country, right? There's lots of people that feel that way. And I actually watched something beautiful the other day. I was learning about Marcus Aurelius and Marcus Aurelius's meditations. He was talking about basically finding purpose, right? All of those things are why you get up out of bed, right? And what he said is that, does a bird or a frog or other animals, do they have to think about what they do when they get up to go do it? No, they wake up and then they do what they need to do because they're a living organism and that's what they're here to do, right? You don't have to believe in, it doesn't matter if you believe in God or not. It doesn't, it really doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is what makes you happy, okay? But either way, whether you believe in a God or a creation or whatever, whatever, right? Regardless, you were born here. You are alive now. And that means that you are going to continue to draw breath and you're going to do things every day until you decide either not to or something happens where you're no longer alive, right? But while you're doing that, why not make the most of it? And that's the problem. Because for me to say that, that is the key. You decide what your purpose is. No one else chooses that for you. You wake up every day and you can say, my purpose today is that I'm going to learn Mandarin, or I'm going to school so I can become this, and then get this job to do these things. Those are goals. Those are part of your life thing. That your goals are part of your purpose. The problem I think that people get hung up on is that they don't know what their purpose is because they don't know that they can choose it. I think, and you know, again, it doesn't matter if you're religious or not, but everybody seems to think that they have to find their purpose rather than just deciding their purpose. And that's it. That's the truth. And the sooner that you realize that, the sooner you can be happy. Because here's an example. When I was going through this phase, right, I'm meditating, I'm doing a lot of self-reflection. One of the things that I did to start was I just made a list. I sat down with a piece of paper and I wrote down all the things that made me happy. And then every day I just tried to add more of those things in there. And as long as I'm doing that, then that's purpose. That gives me something to do. But then through all of that, once I started rewiring my brain, started figuring out who I wanted to be, I found my path. I'm back in school. I'm going to school to be a therapist because I want to help people work through these things like I helped myself work through them. Because it takes a very special kind of person to be able to help you. Because here's the thing. A therapist does not cure you. A therapist does not take away your pain and suffering. A therapist is like a shaman or a monk or a guru. All they're doing is showing you the way home. They're just allowing you to vent and to be yourself and in your presence in such a way that it gives them the space to figure their stuff out.
Yep, that's so true. I think you're right. Like, therapists are really good. And I think their specialty is asking the right questions to get you to sort of open up and sort of peel those layers. One thing I've recently realized is that my mom, growing up and raising me and my two younger sisters, she was, you know, working two jobs as a single mother, just trying to survive. And she never went through the depression, anxiety, because I think she was just doing everything just to survive. And when you mentioned those animals, like the animals, they're literally trying to find their next meal just to survive. So they don't have time to contemplate about life. And nowadays, and I think it's going to get worse and worse, and that's why we probably do need more therapists, is that as things get more and more efficient, and food becomes cheaper, everything becomes cheaper, things become more optimized, people specialize in one thing, so therefore things get cheaper. You're sort of left with so much more time, and all that energy that would have went towards surviving and making that next paycheck now goes to contemplating about life. And I guess that's sort of where that feeling of hopelessness, that lack of why, that questioning on what your purpose is sort of pops up.
It's good. Everything happens for a reason. Okay. And again, I just believe that this is my personal belief. What you just described is basically what the Enlightenment phase in the earth, like during, you know, after the American Revolution, when all of that was happening, the reason people talk about the Enlightenment, but they don't talk about why that happened. The Enlightenment happened because the war was over, and you had all these people with new freedom that they never had before, and they had time to think. The reason why today people are going through this phase is because we have more time to think now. We have more time to think, and that's scary because what you're doing is you're becoming self-realized, right? Or enlightened. That's what this process is. Or if you want to use the philosopher's way of thinking about it, it's Plato's cave, the allegory of the cave. You are climbing out of the cave because you're realizing that there is paradise outside of it, or even the matrix, right? If you want to use a more modern term, this paradigm of your life where you're thinking you got to go to school every day and you got to do these things, right? Like there, again, there is a difference between choosing to do something because you want to do it because that gives you purpose, and then thinking that all of these mundane things you have to do are your purpose. Do you see how those two things sound? One is your freedom and you choosing your life. The other is you being enslaved by what you think is your life.
Most definitely. When the Buddha, when he would meditate to sort of reach enlightenment, do you think he sort of, you know, right now I do meditation 10 minutes every morning, but I'm just focusing on my breath and focusing on clearing my mind. But sort of what you're sort of sharing is that meditating, where you're sort of thinking and questioning things, that might lead to enlightenment. Well, what's your thoughts on enlightenment?
I think enlightenment is really just code for self-realization. Enlightenment is a beautiful word. And it means something, right? Like that's what, you know, we call Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha. The Buddha means the awakened one. And that's a very esoteric term. But what that means is the self-aware person, right? The self-aware person. What does that mean? Self-aware means that you realize what you're doing, right? This is why narcissists have problems with what they're doing. They don't realize what they're doing to other people because they're driving, they're asleep at the wheel. And this is a very difficult, I'm doing my best to explain it simply, but this is a difficult concept for people to understand. There are studies out there that show that only 15% of the world's population are actually like self-aware. But I would say that even less of that are self-aware to the point where they would be considered enlightened, because there is being self-aware. But what we're talking about with people like the Buddha and these gurus and yogis in India is that they're self-aware all the time, which takes practice. It is doable, but it takes practice. And I think that that's why there's been such a disconnect between the ancient traditions of the past and now, is that we look at things like Buddha and enlightenment. We think it's this thing that's unattainable and it's so far away from us and it's magical. Not, it's not. Take Buddha, take Buddhism, all of that, and change those names into psychotherapy and psychology. That is what we're doing. That is what that is.
That's crazy. As you were saying that, it sort of brought something up. Like, as I've been meditating over the last, you know, maybe 3 or 4 years, I have gotten places where on those days I'm just super clear, super focused. I can sort of catch myself drifting off, and let's say now I'm thinking about a book I read the other day. And then I was like, oh, wow. Like, the thing that led me to think about that was, okay, I was thinking about the book that's right next to me. Okay, why did I? I could see these switches of my mind wandering off. Now I haven't gotten to a point where I can really like clearly see what that drifting off thing is, but I'm starting to slowly feel and see that. And it definitely comes into my daily life. Like when I do my cold showers in the morning, as I'm sort of standing there naked, ready to turn, like jump in, I'm catching myself be fearful. I'm like, oh wow, I'm being scared right now. I'm starting to be able to recognize what that feeling of scared is. Right now you sort of just know what it feels like to be scared, but I haven't really categorized or clearly, you know, I don't know how to explain it, clearly sort of know what being scared feels like or what that chemical is. But I'm slowly getting there, and maybe that's what enlightenment is, when you're sort of so self-aware, we can see all the different chemicals that triggers each action, and you could see the waves in your brain that sort of get you to drift off, and you have clarity on all that thing.
That's right. And there's so much depth to it, because even like in Buddhist principles, they have the Eight Noble Fold Path and the Four Noble Truths, right? But some things I want to point out here are things like right speech. What is right speech? Right speech means that you are speaking truthfully and you're speaking clearly so that people, as you were talking about earlier, people can understand you, right? Right thinking. Right thinking is having the right perception. And sometimes that requires relying on others for you to see things right, right? Like, I'm sure we've all heard that thing where it's like, when you stink, right? You stink and other people are telling you that, but you just don't know because you're used to it. Or your room stinks, but you don't because you live in it. You don't recognize it, but somebody walks in and tells you, hey man, your room stinks. It's the same thing with our thoughts, right? All this age of disinformation and this left versus right thinking, that's what this is. It's wrong perception. We're not living in right thought, right thinking. And that is a byproduct of being asleep at the wheel. So when we can learn how to have right speech, which is saying things honestly and speaking truthfully, and we can trust each other to do that, and we can have right thinking, which is that, like, you have the ability to be self-aware enough that when you have a thought like, and I don't know, our government's tyrannical and they're trying to, you know, kill us all by poisoning us and they're poisoning the food, right? Like, that's an extreme thought, okay? And that's not something, you know, even if you wanted to think that that's true, you would need to use other people to confirm that, right? And all we're talking about here is the scientific process, right? That's what experimentation is. It's the same kind of thing. What is experimentation? Is repeated observations with yourself and other people who can back you up. And we say, okay, hey, collectively, we agree this happened, you know, 9 out of 10 times or 10 out of 10 times, we agree that this is what's going on. But for you as an individual to think that you know everything or to think that you have this overall encompassing insight, especially if you're trying to argue something when so many other people are telling you this isn't true, you're not looking at this right, that's when we get lost in our delusions. And that's why Buddhism can help. Buddhism isn't a religion about a god. Buddhism is the religion of psychology. And I think that in the coming years, it'll become more useful, because if we could find principles to live this way, where we trust each other to speak the truth and to help each other see things clearly, I think it could be useful, because right now we're just so individualistic and that's what causes so many problems.
One thing I want to get your thoughts on, Cameron. By the way, I love the Buddhist bracelet.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Those when I was younger. But when you were sort of mentioning, talking about your truth, something that sort of came up was, I was talking to one of my mentors and she was telling me how I'm pretty like head heavy, like I'm pretty logical, and when I speak it feels like I'm speaking from my brain. And I do sort of feel like as an introvert I do get exhausted after sort of hanging in and spending time with people. And she said, you should try practice speaking from your heart. And then if you say things from the heart, yes, you're not sort of thinking about what you say, but no matter what you say, if it comes from the heart, it will always be taken in good faith. Like, people are not gonna, even if you say something wrong, but if it comes from the heart, it's gonna be okay. And that's something I've been trying to practice. I think, like, when I, it's like a switch that I have to switch on, where when I wanna talk from the heart, now I'm sort of just saying what comes to my mind. I'm no longer filtering things, and there's no longer this sort of weight on the words I say, and all of a sudden things are more flowy, things are more natural, more of a sudden I'm smiling more as I talk. What's your thoughts on that concept of speaking from the heart?
I think it's good. I think when what I'm hearing you say, the way that I'm translating it, is that instead of speaking to people logically or almost intellectually, right, to do it with more compassion, to do it with more kindness and to be more relatable. So instead of explaining something the way that you would understand it, maybe you explain it the way that you think that somebody else would understand it, or bring this level down a little bit, right? Like, you're not dumbing anything down. You're making your best attempt to talk to another person and not talk to yourself, because you understand something logically. And this is like, okay, I understand this very well. I can explain this in great detail, but that's only you. Now, I mean, of course, like, it's different from person to person. There might be many people who understand what you're saying at your level. But if this person's giving you that critique, that's what I'm hearing. Speaking from the heart is compassion. You say something with love and with kindness, and you're saying it because you want them to understand. You want them to understand you in the way that you think, not trying to talk to yourself.
Cameron, what do you think helped you grow so much? Like, over the last 4 or 5 years from 2017, what you're sort of telling me of like the version of you when you were in the army to what I'm hearing and seeing now is like so different. There's so much growth and you're so calm, you're so in control. How did you grow so fast in such a small period of time?
Obviously meditating helps. I read a lot of books. When COVID really came down and we were doing the lockdown thing, in probably like a year to a year and a half, I read over 100 books on like mindfulness, meditation, Eastern philosophy. So I got a pretty good grip on it. I got a pretty good taste for it. And, you know, meditation, you know, and I don't even do it every day. Like there was a time in my life where I was doing it hardcore every day. Honestly, I've gotten to a point where I probably should do it every day because I feel better when I do, but it's not detrimental if I don't. Because in Buddhist practice, what we talk about or what they talk about is that non-attachment, right? Which means that you're not attached to even Buddhism, which means meditation is supposed to be a tool, not a crutch. And so if we're using meditation to crutch ourselves through life, right, just like a drug, just like anything else, then it's not actually serving us. So if you can get yourself to a point where meditation is beneficial and you're not, because here's what happens, right? I see this happen to a lot of like people who are new into the spiritual life or new into meditation is that they start beating themselves up if they don't do it every day, kind of like working out, right? I know I should do it, but I didn't. And then I feel guilty about it. Don't. If you didn't do it today, then fine, so be it. There's tomorrow, right? There's the next day. There's right now. If you didn't do it a couple hours ago, fine, do it now, right? Or don't, but don't beat yourself up over it. Don't feel guilty. Because I think this is one of the biggest things that I try to get into people's heads, is that we only have this, whatever this is between you and me, and we're talking and we're in this physical existence, right? You know, throw out all the religious stuff because we don't know, right? If we're reincarnated and we come back, we don't remember. So you can't rely on that. But no matter what, this is limited in this form, right? If I come back, I'm not going to come back exactly this in this form, right? So enjoy it, man. Eat the ice cream you want to eat. Go for a run if you want to run. Do the meditation thing. Watch some movies. But most importantly, find whatever it is that makes you truly happy and do that because you have to. That's purpose, right? You have to find a way to do something that makes you happy because if you don't, you'll be miserable. And then the worst thing you can do is resent being alive.
Interesting. Tell me about the things that sort of you do on your day-to-day basis that makes you happy, Cameron. Is it like the podcast? Is it learning and studying to be a therapist? What are a few things that you just really enjoy doing day to day?
Yeah, I love listening to music. I'm a big fan of classical music. I like listening to podcasts, other people who are doing that kind of work. I like to read. I love to read. I like doing my schoolwork. You know, obviously sometimes it's stressful, but I enjoy it. But I'm not going to try to fool anyone. I still struggle with it. Okay. The last 2 years have been really hard. I think that you'd have to be completely devoid of emotion or feeling to make it through the last 2 years without some kind of problems. But what the difference for me is that I don't live in that. I go through times where I'm down, but what happens is that moment of self-reflection kicks in and I'm like, oh, I'm doing that thing again where I'm sad. I'm doing that thing again where I'm just in a funk and I'm not happy, because it's the beautiful thing is the moment that I remember that that's what's happening, I know exactly what to do to fix it. I'm like, oh, it's time to start meditating every day again. It's time to put down my phone and stop looking at Twitter so much. I need to get back to reading books and listening to music. And it's a switch, you know. What I'm hoping is that, you know, the best version of me, maybe even a year or a couple years from now, is a person who doesn't need to be reminded so often to do that.
That's crazy. As you're bringing up those things, the things that sort of come to my mind is I do love listening to music. I love sort of going casual walks, reading books, just staring at my fish tank and look at all the fishes swim around. And it's sort of these low dopamine, natural sort of activities where I get sort of this pure bliss and happiness from. And you were sort of mentioning similar activities. And I do notice that when I am on social media, when I am binging a TV show, when I am sort of playing games or on YouTube and watching every recommended videos, like I'm just getting so much sort of dopamine, and it's over, like it's just, it's just, it doesn't feel happy. I feel like I'm just eating ice cream all the time. I mean, isn't this sort of natural bliss?
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's addiction, right? And like, that's not to be like negative, like we're all doing it. Like we tend to think of that term, this is why I think Buddhism and therapy go hand in hand, or at least psychology, I really do. Our addictions or attachments, like if you want to talk about that from a Buddhist perspective, that's attachment, right? Addiction is attachment, and we are addicted or attached to our things, right? And you brought up a good point earlier, is that we don't have to focus so much on survival anymore. Really, all we have to focus on is our addictions. What we're going to eat today, what we're going to, you know, how much are we going to sleep tonight? How much homework am I going to get done today? What things am I going to drink? Am I going to have an energy drink or coffee? Am I going to, you know, smoke a vape pen or, you know, do some kind of drugs or whatever, right? Like whatever it is, we are just going from one addiction to the next, to the next, to the next, even though those may take many forms. The bottom line, the root of it is what you talked about, which is the dopamine stimulus, right? Which I don't know. I don't have a solution for that yet. I think that meditation helps, because what it does is meditation gives you the space to see what's happening. Reading books, you know, like that again is taking your focus off of all these other things, and you're putting your focus into this one thing, and it's bettering you. Here's the thing. I don't think that there is a solution for our addictions, but there is something that we can do as a caveat to those addictions. Find addictions that are useful and that actually do things to better your life, like reading books, right? Like I don't think anybody would say that being addicted to reading books is a bad thing, right? It's like, we can't really avoid that in our time and day. But the problem is that, like, think about all those things you mentioned before, right? Like binging a TV show, watching too much TikTok, or spending too much time on Twitter, right? Probably not for the most beneficial, unless what you're watching on a TV show is informative and educational, right? Or at least mixing it up to the point where there is some of that. That's kind of what I'm experimenting with. I don't think that we can cut that out. Like the only way to really do this is just to be a hermit, right? This is the only problem I have with Buddhism, is that I don't believe in living a life completely void of attachments. It's not possible in our day and age, not like this. Unless, again, you're a monk and you live in a monastery, that's fine. That's almost cheating, right? It's almost cheating. Like, we have technology. Technology is useful. It's beautiful. It is great to have all this innovation and stuff. I think the proper way is to learn how to manage that, how to learn how to have time with it, right? Like, here's a simple example. I spend too much time on Twitter, so I set screen time for all my apps. I only allow myself 30 minutes a day to have Twitter, and I do my very best to have self-discipline to not go on there more than that. Because what happens is I get addicted, and I want to look at the news, and I want to learn what's going on, right? But again, you know, when you're obsessing, that's the problem. So anyways, to wrap that part up, I think if we could find ways to take those addictions and turn them into something healthy with a little bit of self-awareness, I think that we could do something good with that.
Literally the other day, I was like, why do people, like a lot of successful people, they all read books. Like, why is reading books so beneficial? Because you literally can get the same amount of content through audiobooks, YouTube, TikTok, and it's the same information. Like, usually when I'm on YouTube, I just watch all these sort of, like, it's sort of like procrastinating, but you're sort of learning those type of content, those business personal development type of content. But why is books sort of the common sort of trend between all successful people? And then one thing I was sort of noticing as I was reading books, and I was like, why is reading difficult? And it's focus. Reading books is helping you sort of get more focus. The people who read a lot of books, they're just super focused. And that's like, I think now I'm starting, as I'm reading books, I'm like, wow, the practicing of me focusing, that probably far outweighs whatever content I learned from that book.
Definitely. Because it's just like meditation. The difference here is that, you know, in your meditation, you're trying to focus on your breathing, or, you know, maybe not focusing on anything at all. You're just trying to create that space. Reading is the same thing. There, you know why reading's hard? Because when people are reading, I mean, I'm sure you can relate to this. It happens to me all the time, is I start thinking about other things while I'm trying to read, right? Like it's the, you know, we call it the monkey mind, right? The overactive mind. And that's why meditation is so valuable, because we need to learn how to get that thing in control. You can't, do you know Sadhguru? Have you ever heard of Sadhguru?
Yes.
Sadhguru is great. One of the most important things I think he said was that he had somebody asked him when he was talking, how do you stop the mind, right? He said, can you stop your heart from beating? Can you stop your liver from processing toxins? No, you can't. Your mind, your brain is this beautiful, super advanced organism, like organic computer, basically. That's what it's meant to do. It's meant to analyze. It's meant to think. It's meant to be doing that, right? You don't want that to stop. What you need to do is find how to use it, right? How do you use that thing beneficially? I was just thinking about this today about focused contemplation time, an hour of day where my purpose is to be secluded by myself and to think, and to just think, not to just go into the, you know, and think about a million different things, like thinking with a purpose. And that is giving it, that is giving your mind something to occupy it, right? That's what it wants. It wants to be occupied. It needs something to focus on, which is why we like books and podcasts and things. But I think that that's the whole root of the problem right there.
I've been doing this thing where sometimes a thought would come up, be like, okay, how am I gonna build a system that would, I would quit TV shows. And all of a sudden my brain is thinking of how to solve this problem I have while I'm eating breakfast or while I'm getting some work done. And I've been recently writing it down, putting it up on like a to-do list, and having this sort of thought activity. That's like a to-do activity. Like half an hour just to think about this problem and solve it. And I think that's something that I definitely want to sort of do much more. And it helps, one, compartmentalize things where you're sort of really thinking about that one problem and setting time aside for it. And two, you're now taking it away from your brain so you can sort of focus at the task at hand. Another thing I've realized is that during periods of meditation, when I am meditating throughout the months, I'm able to snap out of things much easier. I'm able to catch myself going a rabbit hole on YouTube and close it and get back to doing work. But when I'm not meditating, I'm like, it's much more difficult. I'm stuck in those rabbit holes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, again, that's common. I have this problem too. You know, especially when it comes to schoolwork, right? Like if it's something boring, like if it's a paper that I don't really want to write, it's very easy for me to be like, oh, I don't want to, like, I'm reading this book, David Hume, he's a philosopher, right? And, this book, it's not even that long, but it's just dry. It's dry and it's boring. Even though I love philosophy, it's just like trying to read through mud. But, you know, that's a beautiful process, right? Marcus Aurelius talked about, I wish I could remember the words he used again, but basically forced pain, right? And this might sound a little bit harsher than what he actually said, but basically what he talked about is forcing yourself to do something hard, because if you can do that, then you're not just trying to live your life comfortably. No other animal does as much to provide comfort for themselves as humans do. We do almost everything with the intent and purpose to create comfort for us. And that could be part of our problem. So if you force yourself, you meditate and you take cold showers, that is one of those processes. You're doing something hard because you're forcing yourself. You're using the willpower you have to do something challenging. And that's beneficial to the mind. That's beneficial to your body. Learning how to do things that are hard are beneficial to us, because then when you're like, all right, well, I can force myself to take a cold shower every morning, sitting down and writing this, you know, paper is nothing. That's the point.
Cameron, tell me about your book and your podcast. How long ago did those things start? How'd you get into it?
So I started my podcast, Hermit Radio, about 2 years ago. And it was because I had gone through this, you know, this thing in my life where I'm changing. And I kind of had this moment where I really did just wake up, right? Like it felt like I really did just hit the enlightenment spot. And the very first thing, which is, it's kind of funny because in my philosophy class, we just got, you know, we were talking about Plato and Plato's cave. And part of Plato's cave is that when the philosopher gets out of the tunnel and gets out into the real world, he sees that it's paradise and it's beautiful. But what he realizes is that it's lonely and that he's by himself. Everyone else is still in the cave. And then he's got to go back into the cave to try to convince other people to get out. And that's what I did. And it, not just me, many others, obviously, right? Many others, Buddha, the Christ, Gandhi, you know, any prophet or yogi or guru that's come before, this is exactly what they're doing. Any philosopher included, is that they've tasted paradise, which is the freedom of the mind. And now they have gone back into the cave to try to free other people because it's lonely at the top. And the biggest thing that I try to say is that this mindset is great for me, but it really doesn't mean anything if the rest of the world can't be there either. Because even though I'm this, you know, Zen person, as we said, I still am living in the world of, you know, social media, crap, political nonsense, COVID, Ukraine, Russia war, right? Like we're all living in that. And it's the best Zen monk in the world that has access to all these tools and social media. It's very hard to maintain that. So that's why I made the podcast. You know, little did I know that when I first started the podcast, it was right before COVID happened. I just wanted to share my thoughts. I just wanted to share with people about what I was learning about myself and these, you know, these crazy ideas about how to free our minds and how to deal with anxiety. And the same thing with the book. You know, I wanted to write, I always wanted to write a book, but I found something truly that meant something to me about it. And I wrote this book, Caveman to Philosopher, and I shared it with a lot of people. And almost everyone that's read it said that they loved it and that it gave them something, something to do. I can't tell you, there's been several people who like keep the book with them and have like highlighted parts of it and they go back and read it several times, which I can relate to because I have books like that or podcasts like that, that I go back and re-listen to because I need like another like boost.
My next question that came to mind, I was going to ask, like, how'd you go about writing that book? And I think I sort of answered the question as I was thinking, because like I've probably only read like maybe 30 books in my lifetime and I'm trying to read more. So I guess I just have no idea how to structure a book. Do you think it came naturally because you've read hundreds of books and you sort of knew how you want to structure it? Or did you Google how to write a book?
No, I just kind of winged it, you know. I did think about how I wanted to structure it a little bit. You know, I kind of made like a general outline. And then I just started writing. And it was easy for me because the first half of the book is just my life. You know, I just talked about my life and like, because I wanted people to understand where I was coming from. Because when I start talking about all this, you know, Zen monk stuff, like I want them to understand where I was coming from. Because even you within 10 minutes of talking to me, could see that. You're like, whoa, this dude is a war vet and he's, you know, but he seems like something else, right? And that's what I wanted to portray to people. I wanted to see, because what that means is that other people can do it too. If I did it, anyone can do it.
One thing I want to quickly touch on is loneliness. Something that I'm really noticing really recently is that all the people around me, all my friends, all my peers, they're all at different stages of life. And I can see myself, and I've been through all these stages, like the stage of, all right, I'm hustling, I'm trying to grind and become the best version of myself and just climb this corporate ladder. The version of, oh, I'm just focused on myself, so I'm going to reply to my friend every 48 hours. The person who's scheduled things months ahead of time and then they just fill up their calendars so they will have another chance to be on their own and it's hard to book in and catch up with them. Because recently, as I've sort of cut off YouTube, cut off TV, I have all this extra time and I want to hang out with friends and I'm noticing, wow, everyone's busy, everyone's at different stages of their life and it's going to take a while for them to get to a place where they're just happy with what they do and I could just message them, hey, do you want to do something this afternoon? And they'd say yes. It feels like everyone's saying no, everyone's busy, and it's starting to feel lonely.
You know, again, in like Buddhist terms, fear always comes back to three things, and that's fear of dying, fear of pain or sickness, and fear of loss, loneliness. And again, this is not uncommon, especially right now. The only thing I can say is that typically the loneliness is a byproduct of not being 100% in love with yourself. I know that sounds silly, but I'd like to use the guy Keanu Reeves as an example. You know, people have asked him, like, you know, don't you ever get lonely, you know? And he goes, no, I take myself out on dates, you know, I take myself to the movies. Now, that does not mean that you should never hang out with people or that you should just, you know, be void of them. That's not what I'm advocating for. What I'm advocating for is that you shouldn't need other people to feel loved or to enjoy life. They should be the bonus. They should be the cherry on top or the something extra, right? This is why relationships are a problem. Relationships, the number one problem is that I am trying to get love from you and you are trying to get love from me, but neither of us know how to love. We just want it from each other, right? But if I don't know how to love myself, how could I ask you to give me love, right? Because you want the same thing. It's not two people who love each other and that are hanging out. It's I want something from you and you want something from me, which now makes it a transaction, makes it a business or, you know, deal, which is not conducive to that. That doesn't produce love. That's why so many marriages end in divorce. If we, you know, it's so silly, right? How many times have you heard you got to love yourself before you can love somebody else, right? But we don't really listen to that because we think it's nonsensical, although it is the truth. The loneliness that we feel is because of the discontent we have for what's going on around us already. And if that's how you feel, then maybe it's time for change, right? Like maybe you do need to spend more time with some other people, or you need to find a way to do what you're doing in a way that makes you feel better and brings that feeling back to you. Because I've worked with people all the time and they have the same problem. And what I see is that I have this one friend who's all, you know, he gets in relationships and as soon as he's in the relationship, it gets to a high point and then it comes crashing down. And as soon as that happens, the relationship's over. And then as soon as he starts working on himself again, doing all these things that he wants to do for himself, he gets back into a high place, but he keeps doing the same things over and over again, right? But if he had just stopped trying to do that other thing where he's chasing after somebody and he sticks with the self-improvement, sticks with what makes him happy, and he stays at that high point, he has something much better to offer somebody else when he's reached that top.
Interesting, that cycle that you just mentioned. Over the last few years, I've spent so much time working on myself and getting to a point where I'm super independent. I'm going camping on my own. I do activities. I love going to the city and just cycling around the city just on my own. And I got to a point where I really did love myself. And then I have noticed a weird shift over the last few months where I've gone to a point where I was like, okay, like I'm pretty happy on my own. I want to start bringing people into my life. I sort of figured myself out and I want to sort of share it with people. And I've sort of brought people into my life. It was that cherry on top. It was like, wow, like life is even better. And this is a cherry on top. But what's happening over the last few months is that cherry on top is starting to become not a cherry on top and become part of the ice cream, and I'm starting to rely on and crave it. And I do, you sort of helped me snap out of it. I do need to take a step back and go back to doing things on my own and embracing that and not expecting to have that cherry on top.
No, and to be clear, you know, we're living in a very different time. I don't think it's not, you know, for you to be perfect and happy doesn't mean you have to be a hermit. You don't have to be by yourself all the time. I think that it's natural right now for us dealing with COVID and dealing with politics and, you know, the threat of impending war all the time. I think it's only natural that we want to have each other, right? Like some of my best thinking is done when I'm talking to other people, right? Discussing discourse. But here's the problem. People right now are sidetracked, or their focus is on all this other chaotic stuff. Whereas people like yourself, you are very driven and focused and you have these things in mind, whereas most other people don't have that, right? Which is why it's hard to connect with people and to be like, hey, I've got this time free. I've got an hour. Do you want to go hang out? The other person, probably not, because their mind is a battlefield. And they're like, I can't hang out with you because I don't even want to hang out with myself right now. And that's the problem.
And I think what's happening is, because I went from hanging out on my own and never reaching out to anyone, to reaching out to people here and then catching up with my friends every few months, to like reaching out to like five people at a time on days where I just smash out the day early. It's 3 p.m. I want to hang out. Let's hit up three people, five people. And then I'm getting a bunch of rejections. Hey, I'm busy. Hey, let's do something next week. And I think that rejection is a bit hurting my ego. And I do feel like, man, like I'm amazing. I'm super cool. Why don't you want to hang out with me? And it's sort of crazy that rejection, it doesn't feel good. And I'm like, but then I want to hang out with people. And then if I've already experienced being independent and loving myself and just doing my own thing, I've done there, I want something different. So it's this weird give and take, and it's I'm in an awkward position.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that the other thing to consider too is that the people that you spend time with should be people that also have the same things in mind. You know, I struggle with this myself. You know, I'm a kind of person, I'm always in deep thought. I think about things that in the academic world, philosophy and psychology, you know, not many people want to talk about those things. Not many people want to think that deeply. And so I get it. So that's why I spend a lot of time on my own. But what I've realized, just like yourself in the last couple months, is that I need to find people that are more of that caliber, that want to talk and think about those things. And that's the key. It might take time to find it, but once you find those people and you get that, like, your own little click, it'll make more sense. And I think that it'll happen better for you. So this is something too that I've realized in my age, is that the friends that we grow up with don't always end up being the friends that we should have or should stick with, right? It's okay to evolve. We change, right? As an individual, we change all the time. Why shouldn't our friends change, right? Like, it doesn't mean you have to cut anybody off, but if the pool of friends you have is not available, make new friends, find new people that share those same ideas, right? But that's scary for a lot of people. That's scary because there's anxiety encompassed in that. Meeting new people is scary, but there's so many people in this world, and there, you know what I mean? For all you know, there's a person out there that is exactly like you, and you two will be like this, right? And brainstorming new ways to change the world. And all it takes for you to meet that person.
Over like the last few months, where I was sort of on, like, actually the whole of last year, 2021, it was just a whole journey and year just to figure myself out and who I am as a person and my sort of worldview. And then I went from not hanging out with people because I knew they weren't similar or we were just different, to realizing that, wow, I can actually bring people into my world. Now that I have clarity and conviction behind my thoughts and my worldview and things I enjoy, I can now start sharing it with people and bring people in. All of a sudden I'm like, wow, this topic that I would normally not talk about with this person, I'm now talking about it and they're reciprocating, they're either listening or now they're bringing ideas. I'm like, wow, this is like a whole different type of relationship we have now, because I'm bringing up the topics I enjoy to talk about. And that's sort of why I went complete 360. And I was like, I just want to hang out with everyone. And now I sort of know how to steer the conversation towards the things I like to talk about. And in situations where I can't steer it and there's this weird sort of not matching situation, then I sort of have confirmation that that person is probably not a right fit. But I'm finding that a lot of people that I thought wasn't a right fit has became a right fit.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good that you can find that. You know, a lot of times you have to wonder this, you know, if you want a fun exercise in what I'm kind of talking about is just, you know, just go to some random public place, like, you know, to get coffee or whatever, and just listen, be a fly on the wall and listen to other people's conversations. What blows me away is, you know, and it's not about interest, and this is not like being judgy or anything like that by any means, but I find it interesting to hear what people are talking about, right? Like, it cracks me up, people who sit around and talk about sports all the time. I'm like, bro, like, there's so much other shit going on in the world. Like, how can you just sit here and talk about, you know, football for 5 hours, right? Or cars, or, you know, whatever, you know? I'm like, do you know about, you know, David Hume? What do you think about this idea, right? Like, do you know how the brain works and why these receptors work this way, whatever? Right? I mean, like, they probably think I'm the weirdo, right? Like, I'm the weirdo because I'm just always out here doing this, when most other people are much down to earth and they're centered on those things. But we talk and we do what's comfortable. And sometimes those things are just more comfortable to be around.
Most definitely. And I think I'm learning that you can slowly start steering people into that sort of worldview, and you'd be surprised how curious they'd be. But obviously there have been situations where they're just like, it's just talking to a brick wall, and they definitely don't want to be talking about those things. But yeah, I guess, Cameron, tell me about what the future lies. What do you want to do in the next few years? Like, what's the plan for the podcast and becoming a therapist? I'm really curious.
So I've got a few more years of my undergrad work to do in psychology, and then I'll go get a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling, which will allow me to do the therapy stuff. And my plan is to incorporate my meditation and mindfulness and Buddhist practices into my therapy. I want to create something like that. I wouldn't be the first. It's just not very common. There's not many people doing that. But I feel like what I'm doing is important, which is why I'm doing these podcasts and writing books. I want to write more books. So right now I'm just bogged down by school, so I don't have a whole lot of free time to write. But that's it for me. You know, I'm continuing to do my podcast and trying to change things up with my podcast. I want to do like a call-in show where people can call into my podcast and we can talk about these kind of conversations, because I want to hear from people instead of me just talking all the time. And then, you know, the rest of it is just keeping it zen, you know, trying to keep myself in check and being stoic about everything that goes on while the world is on fire.
Do you find the podcast is really therapeutic? Like, I've been doing these sort of 5 to 10 minute videos where I just talk about the things I'm experiencing. I'm just talking to the camera. And every time I sort of film one of these videos, it's like a weight is just off my shoulders. And I also gain clarity against that thought. Also take it out of my mind. It's no longer bogging me in my brain. And I also sort of make sure and then I hold myself accountable to that idea.
Yeah, I am, you know, for the longest time, I mean, really still, if I'm being completely honest, when I do my podcast, I don't research anything. I don't plan it out. Like when I very first started, I just hit record and I started talking. And it was almost like I was being kind of like divinely guided in what I was saying, but it just came out of me. Kind of like, you know, we were talking earlier, talking from the heart. That's kind of what it felt like I was doing, because it's weird. I would just open my mouth and these things would come out and it made sense and they were beautiful and people loved it and resonated with it. I mean, to this day, my podcast has been listened to around the world in so many different countries. And I never thought that it would have the reach that it did. I mean, just the other day, one of my fans emailed me talking about how it, you know, it's been impacting their life, and they've been following me for a year now, and they love. I met somebody at my place of work. They recognize my voice, and they're like, "Are you like? Do you have a podcast? Do you talk about like, you know, keeping your anger in check in traffic?" I'm like, "Yeah." And he pulls up his phone and shows my podcast. He's like, "Is that you?" I'm like, "Yeah, that's me." And so that's fulfilling. It's rewarding for me. That makes me feel like what I'm doing matters, and that's what I care about. Because that's, again, like, to bring it back to the beginning, is that's purpose.
Do you have any tips for growing a podcast? I remember when I was sort of doing it solo, I had like maybe 10, 20 listeners that would check in each week, but it wouldn't grow. But then I sort of started bringing on guests, and that's sort of when the growth comes. Do you have any tips for growing podcasts?
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's a lot of resources out there, but like one of the big things is definitely, like you said, bringing on guests, right? You know, and here's the thing about guests, okay? All you have to do is ask. Shoot for the stars, right? Shoot for the stars. All they can say is no, but then there's the chance that they might say yes. And think about that, right? These people, you know, I've had like some quasi famous people on my podcast, and all they had to do is ask. And that's all it took. And I'm glad that I did. And all it takes is for you to not be anxious about it and to just do it. The second thing is I would say social media is a tool, right? Not necessarily to go on social media and spam your links, but like there's places that are helpful. Like on Reddit, there's a subreddit called Podcast Guest Exchange, right? Where you can go there and ask for guests, or you can go on there and look for podcasts to be on, right? Because you going on other podcasts is you talking to their audience, which might make them interested in you coming to, you know, them coming to your podcast. It's about networking. It's about connecting with people. You know, you just got to keep that mindset that you're going to grow. And not get disgruntled when it doesn't grow right away. It takes time. It always does, you know, and podcasts are not new anymore, but they're still new enough to where you can grow like that.
Amazing. Cameron, where can people hear more about your story, learn about your lessons, and follow along on your journey?
Yeah, I would just say you can check into my podcast. That's Hermit underscore Radio. So just Hermit Radio. And, you know, you can either start from the last episode that I did, or you can go all the way back to the beginning. What I will say is that the very beginning of the podcast is me sharing my feelings and my stories and talking about what changed. And then the more recent episodes, I've been interviewing intellectuals and academics, and we're talking about some of the things going on in the world. And my point with all of that is trying to get people to understand their thoughts, feelings, and emotions so that we can deal with some of these things, right? Because again, it's like I was saying about technology. It's not about getting rid of them. We're never going to get rid of politics. We're never going to get rid of war and these other things. We've got to learn how to live with them and how to live with our minds right so that we can get through it.
Thank you so much, Cameron. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on this podcast. I know it's a Sunday night, so I really appreciate it. I just love how calm and zen, and then how you're on this journey to then pass on these lessons that has helped you get to where you are. I can definitely feel it, and I can feel your compassion for and want to help people and share what you've learned. And I can definitely feel that energy through the screen. And I really, you know, like, just doing this podcast, I could feel like if I was on the other side, you interviewing me, like it would be so therapeutic. You just have that sort of therapeutic sort of energy. And yeah, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, Andy, thanks for having me on. And I'll tell you what, since you said that, I want to leave you with something, okay? And this is for your listeners too, whoever's listening. But I'm going to say something. This doesn't require you to answer. There's no right or wrong. But I just want you to think about it. And whatever it means to you, that's what's going to come to you, okay? But I want you to think about this. Now, in a valley where there are two peaks, a river cannot flow. But in a valley with one peak, a river can flow flawlessly. And there's no right or wrong answer to that. There's nothing that you can do to find the answer to that. The answer to that is within you, right? And everyone's version of the truth of that is going to come to them in their own way, right? And I'll say it again, just so everybody listening can go back to it again if they need to. But in a valley with two peaks, a river cannot flow. But in a valley with one peak, a river can flow flawlessly.
As you're saying that, I don't fully sort of understand it, but I'm sort of visualizing sort of these mountain ranges, and I'm seeing, okay, well, what that means to me is like when there's two people or two mountains, for some reason I see them as people, and if there's sort of two people, it's hard for there to be any sort of you know, the cup is not full, the cup is not, you know, the saying where you have to look after your own cup before you can start filling other people's cup. That's sort of what comes to my mind when you have one mountain. There is space and there is energy. There is a surplus, which is sort of the flowing river. But when there is another person, it sort of takes up that space and energy. That's sort of what I'm feeling as I'm listening to that thing. I know when I sort of hear things for the first time and I haven't solidified that thought, it comes up really messy, but yeah.
Well, now let's try to bring it into focus. Is there something in your life personally that makes you think of?
It makes me think of me, where right now when I'm sort of independent, I'm on my own, I do have all this energy to give and I have all this surplus and I want to bring people in my life. But I can definitely see that if I do find, say, an amazing partner that has all the qualities I'm looking for and is very similar to me, my world might get shut off. I might no longer be reaching out to five people every day because I have one person that I'm hanging out with every day and we do things together. That's sort of what comes to my mind personally, I guess.
I think you should explore that some more. I think you should think about what that means for you, because really everyone's answer is a reflection of their subconscious mind. whatever anyone's answer is, because again, there is no right or wrong. I've asked this question a million times and I've gotten a million answers back. It's always a reflection of your subconscious. So I would explore that. I would ask yourself in the next day or two, you know, just what does that mean? And you know, what's funny is it might even just manifest itself. You might have an interaction today, tomorrow, or this week where something happens and you're like, oh, wow, this is that thing. Now, let me throw this out there too, right? And I said, there's a very important word I said about the river, right? I said flow, right? It either does or it doesn't. It's either going to flow or it doesn't flow, right? Flow is something that comes with ease and it's natural. It just happens. And if anything's blocking it, or if it becomes too hard, or if there's resistance, then it's not flowing.
Interesting. Another thing that's coming to my mind now is like, there is this sort of societal pressure where it feels like I need to find a partner. I need to have someone with me. But there is a chance, and I think deep down my heart, it probably is that I am built to be this lone soldier. And I do enjoy. I enjoy hanging out with all types of people. And maybe I'm not meant to find someone. I think I'm only subconsciously wanting to find someone because of societal norms, and I'm ignoring that my gut feeling doesn't want me to do that anyways.
Yeah, it's possible. I think that there's truth in that. I do think that is a societal norm to have people, right? But I mean, if that was true, then why do we have so many divorces, right? Now, what I will say, and I don't want this to be discouraging for you or for your listeners, doesn't mean that it's forever, right? Maybe it's just right now. Maybe right now what you need is to be you and to let people come into your life, right? I mean, this is, of course, the classic romance story too, right? Like when you spend all your time looking for somebody, you never find them. And it's the moment you stop looking that person finds you, right?
Interesting. Cameron, tell me your relationship to that question.
Well, when I originally was thinking of it, what I vision is a question, or it is a parable of the mind, right? When our minds are divided, and when I say our minds divided, I mean the ego, the person that we're pretending to be, and then our true selves, right? Who are we all? You know, everybody's pretending to be somebody, right? Like, and that could be as big as I'm pretending to be, you know, a billionaire playboy to try and entrap women to liking me, or just the simple thing of me pretending to be somebody named Cameron. Cameron's just a name. It's not real, right? I just accept it for what it is. You accept it as an agreement we have between each other that you're going to call me Cameron. But if I didn't have a name up there, you wouldn't call me that. You'd just assume that I was somebody else, right? My point is that even this person that I am, it's all just part of the game. And what happens is when we are disillusioned by who we're pretending to be versus who we want to be or who we truly are, that stops us from flowing. When we embrace who we want to be and stop pretending, then we can flow and it becomes easy. That's what life needs to be. That's why we're in so much pain right now, collectively in society. Too many people pretending and not enough people getting to be who they want to be.
That's beautiful. I love that interpretation of the two being you and you trying to figure yourself. That's like, yeah, that's such a great question, because you're right, each person interprets it completely different, and that's why it has to be vague. Yeah, it has to be like, this is it. And then all of a sudden, like, you get really different answers, and each answer is probably correct and makes sense, and there is no right answer.
That's right. That's the same, you know, any parable from the Buddha or from Jesus or the Zen koans, it's the same thing. It seems mystical. It seems like there's this secret formula. There isn't. It's always been inside of you. You just have to figure it out for yourself, right? There is no right answer. It's what comes to you, because again, you are perceiving this reality, right? Regardless of everyone else, you, the way that you are living your life, you, your perception, your awareness is yours and yours alone. Which means that this universe is only yours and yours alone. We're all collectively sharing this experience together while also simultaneously in our own universe, if that makes sense.
Interesting. Thank you so much, Kim. I really appreciate your time today. This has been a great episode. I had a lot of fun on this episode.
Well, anytime, you know, I'm down for a part two if you want. Also, I will make sure to send you, I know I didn't do it yet, but I will send you a copy of my book so you can read that too.
Most definitely, I'd love that. But yeah, thank you so much, guys, for listening to this episode. This is another episode of The Flip Side, and hopefully you guys got some value on this episode. But yeah, thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you guys next week. Peace.